My name is Mel Schloss. I'm a physician. I'm a surgeon. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon here at McGill University. And it's my pleasure to moderate this evening's lecture. I'd also like to thank Cappy Flanders for inviting me. I used to do this in my other life. We had a mini med series. It was very similar to the series you're attending, and it was maybe some of you even went, some of the CGEP students perhaps. But it was a series that was much the same as we have tonight. But how many of you are CGEP students, just a raise of your, and high school students? So it's about 50-50, I guess, almost. And what grade in high school, last grade, seniors? So it's a mix, all levels. And you all have a strong interest in the health sciences, I presume. Doctors, you want to go into medical school, pharmacy, what else? Great, physiotherapy, health, nursing, terrific. Well, they're all good specialties, so I'm sure you're finding these lectures very interesting. This is the fourth in the series of lectures. Tonight we're going to have Dr. Dan Deckelbaum talk about global health, past and future directions. We want to thank our sponsors, the McGill Office for Science and Society. And I think that's it. And for those of you who are live streaming tonight with the webcast, if you want to ask a question, just email it to minimed.med@mcgill.ca. So it's my pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker and lecturer, Dr. Dan Deckelbaum. I'll just say a few words because I think you have his bio in your handout. They don't have that. Oh, then I'll say more than a few words. Dr. Deckelbaum is assistant professor at the Division of Trauma at the General Surgery at McGill University Health Center. He obtained his subspecialty training in trauma surgery and critical care at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. And during his fellowship training, he also completed a master's of public health at the University of Miami. So in addition to his passion for clinical practice, Dr. Deckelbaum has developed an avid interest in global surgery education and development, as well as disaster preparedness and response. He has established and co-directs the MUHC Center for Global Surgery. He has built programs in middle-income nations, really all over the world, including Haiti, Tanzania, Rwanda, Ukraine, and in the Middle East. So, Dan, it's my pleasure to introduce you as a lecturer for tonight.
Thank you very much, Mel. And I'd also like to thank Ibi Schuster and Cappy Flanders for their invitation. It really is an honor here to come here and to speak to you today. It's not often that we get to speak to younger students that are embarking on careers in health sciences, and I hope this presentation will entice you into pursuing careers in global health, in fact, because I clearly have a significant passion for it. I'm one of the trauma surgeons up at the Montreal General Hospital, and if you ever have any questions or want to just meet, I'm pretty busy, but always available. So just let me know, and I'm happy to do so. Today, I'm going to be speaking about global health, a bit about the past and the future. And I'm going to put a bit of a surgical twist to it, as that is my specific interest. We're going to talk about definitions, some of the settings that we work in, the challenges that we face, and capacity building, and we'll talk about what that means exactly and a bit what the future directions are for capacity building. A lot of pictures here. All the pictures were obtained with consent from whoever's in the pictures, including any wildlife that's been there. So let's just talk a bit about global health, international health. We used to call it international health. And that definition or that title has, in fact, changed to global health. And the reason is that when we think international, the first thing we think of is borders, visas, almost restrictive in nature. And that definition has switched towards global health. And the beauty of the word global is that it, in fact, transcends any national boundaries. And this can therefore be global health locally and across oceans, across continents, and nations. And in fact, the borders are meaningless. So what is really global health? And that's something that epidemiologists, public health specialists, physicians have been really tackling that definition for years and years, and this will probably continue to be discussed for years and years. But probably the best definition that I've come across by people that are much smarter than I am is a definition that's published in The Lancet, and they talk about it being an area of study, research, and practice that places a priority on improving health and achieving equity in health for all people worldwide. That is not just in sub-Saharan Africa, South America, Asia. It, in fact, is in the northern Quebec, northern Ontario, anywhere where there is health inequality. I just want to go through and just show you a little bit what the setting that we work in because it's very different from here in the hospitals. And here we have incredible technology. We have an incredible ability to support life. And that may not always be available in some of the resource-limited settings that we work in. This is a district hospital in eastern Kenya, in a region called Ngao, where one hospital, which has one doctor, which is pretty much a medical school graduate, covers a population of about 500,000 people. Here at the Montreal General Hospital, we have countless physicians, about countless surgeons, covering a much smaller population, so respectively, because we have multiple hospitals in the region. So you can imagine a graduating medical student suddenly requiring to do C-sections, appendectomies, difficult diagnoses and treatments in this region. These are some of the images within the hospital, and you can see the bed netting on top, which is the mosquito net, in order to protect from malaria. This is another hospital. This is probably the fourth largest hospital in Kenya. Again, serving a population of several millions, and that's it. This is the main operating room theater and inside some of the residents that are working in surgery. And you can see that we're not using some of the highest technology here. This is the electrocautery machine, which usually here is a disposable instrument, but over there, because there is no supplies, not as much financial capacity to buy some of these resources, then a machine that is used to stop bleeding now is reused over and over and sterilized over and over in the autoclaves, so it pretty much melts. Not only are our capacities different, but we also see different pathologies. So when I did my training in Miami, and when I would get a call from the intern and he would say to me, I have an 18-year-old gentleman here, he was shot in the chest, I would say, okay, what caliber of bullet was it? What was the distance? Was it a high velocity or a low velocity bullet? Here, in this setting, Very different situation. This is not a bullet, this is an arrow from a bow and arrow. So the questions are different. Is it embedded in the chest? Does it have a rugged edge? Because if it's smooth, you can potentially just pull it out. If it's not, you have to operate on this patient. And does it have a poisonous tip, which has other medical implications that we would otherwise not have? So clearly very different challenges. And this is us operating on this young gentleman and taking out this arrow. Again, different security concerns. This is a young gentleman that was a parking attendant that was slashed with a panga, which is otherwise known as a machete. And, you know, he came in with his trachea lacerated, his esophagus completely lacerated. And now with very little resources, we had to provide and try to achieve similar level care that he would otherwise get over here. And in fact, they have phenomenal staffing. They may not have as much staffing in some of these regions, but they are extremely dedicated. They work extremely hard, and I learned a lot from them. And as a team, everybody was able to pretty much operate and care for this patient so that 2 weeks later he was discharged from hospital. Here he would have probably gotten about 80 sets of laboratory blood draws over the 2 weeks. In Kenya, he got one. Again, we would get to some of these regions. This is some time that I spent with the Flying Doctor Service and using this Cessna Grand Caravan. And you really get to some of the extreme regions in Africa. And one of the incredible things that to me was very difficult, in fact, is that we would go to a town or a region such as Ngao, and this actually happened. There were tremendous rains and flooding. And we were completely surrounded, and all the roads and all the access was blocked. So there was no way for us to leave by ground. And immediately you saw that in this village, the prices of care went up, the prices of the phone went up, whoever had a phone, the prices of food tripled, quadrupled, and just that one rainstorm had a significant adverse impact on the local population. And for us, how privileged we are to have been able to call a plane when our time was there, take off, and be able to escape into a new reality, whereas a significant population stayed there and they had to continue to struggle with some of the environmental challenges. So again, we're privileged in order to be able to do that. And that brings into the point that, you know, one of the things that we need to do is improve capacity, build local capacity, that some of these missions where you go and you operate for a week, when you leave, the baseline of the country has not necessarily changed. Whereas if you train the healthcare personnel and healthcare leadership over there, if you work with them so that they can provide the care that you would otherwise provide, when you leave, their capacity is in fact increased and they can perform what you have done. So their level is increased. If you don't do that, then as soon as you leave, everything is back to baseline. Again, very different settings. You know, everybody's always excited when you arrive. This is another consideration that you have, especially when working in some of the hostile environments. And this is a flight into Mogadishu after a double suicide bombing. So again, now you are faced with a dangerous environment, and therefore your management is probably going to change a little bit. So for example, you're not going to have the time and luxury to manage patients on the ground. You're not going to have the time and luxury to treat patients over there. put them on the spine boards, et cetera, et cetera. You have to really scoop and run, get them out as quickly as possible, because there's bombs going off in the background and there's shootings. And so you want to try to evacuate as quickly as possible, scoop and run. And these patients in the aircraft here are African Union forces that were injured during this double suicide bombing. You don't have the same ambulances as we do here. Ambulances is pretty much a back of a truck, and this is out of a massacre in northern Kenya where some of the survivors had to be evacuated in a truck, and there are actually two patients over there, and referred to a local hospital. The disaster scenario, and this is out of Haiti, presents a very different challenge. In this scenario, you have to suddenly augment, or there is a sudden increase in the number of patients that you have to treat. And in these scenarios, there is a significant participation by some of the NGOs in order to try to help the local capacity deal with the challenge. And this is the palace in Haiti, the presidential palace, and this is across from the university hospital. This is one of the nursing schools. So Haiti's healthcare capacity significantly deteriorated after the earthquake, and here's a perfect example. So in this nursing school, 100 nursing students, in fact, passed away as a result of this earthquake, and this is the nursing building. So you can imagine all these trainees that would otherwise go and now serve their community and serve their country, you've completely stopped that. So there is this tremendous regrowth that's necessary after disasters such as the one in Haiti, and really the one in Haiti is probably the most concentrated natural disaster, that caused the most concentrated number of deaths in recent history. Talking about ambulances, there you go. We don't have ambulances. The capacity is completely, completely destroyed. So wheelbarrows were used to bring patients to hospitals. Some of the tent cities, there were about 1 million internally displaced people that lived in tents for a significant amount of time. The hospitals were completely overwhelmed. There were patients on the floors, in the halls, under beds, over beds, and that is just because of the significant surge of patients that came from the disaster. And what's interesting is that in Port-au-Prince, in fact, the healthcare capacity was completely destroyed. So anybody that knew anything in Haiti at the time, they would use the peripheral hospitals, which were unaffected by the earthquake, and so patients would come by the busload over to the peripheral hospitals, where in fact it's Haitian physicians, Haitian nurses that provided care, while a lot of the NGOs were setting up for the first 5 to 8 days in Port-au-Prince. That's a very important point, and very few in fact talk about what Haiti and Haitians did for Haiti. Immediately after the earthquake, it's Haitian surgeons, Haitian physicians, Haitian nurses, Haitian janitors. Everybody was Haitian that was taking care of Haitians. It wasn't some of the NGOs. And I think we need to give significant credit to those Haitians that did this work, because it wasn't us. We didn't do anything initially. And it's incredible to see, you know, NGOs come and go, and Haiti actually stays and serves their population. And that, again, begs the point that we need to augment local capacity in order to have a longer-lasting effect on healthcare infrastructure in the region. This is the lineup to the operating room. And again, when we would round in the morning, we would ask the patients that they would have to be. We would decide which patients needed to go to the operating room, but we didn't have enough nurses, enough porters, enough physicians to wheel the patients to the operating room, and so the family members would have to do so. And we would go from bed to bed to bed and say, you're going to the operating room, you need an operation today. And I remember saying that to one of the families, and I turned and I saw another patient, and as I turned back to go into the hallway, I suddenly see an old 70-year-old lady about yay high, very skinny, and she's trying to push one of these beds, which is quite heavy. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, you asked us to push this bed over to the operating room. And I was embarrassed, in fact, because I asked the family, and here was the family, a 70-year-old woman, almost, it's an impossible feat for her to push, but it just shows the drive and the motivation that they had to help their own people during this situation. After the earthquake, there was a significant number of patients that were amputees, and again, local hospitals this is one of the prosthesis factories that built their own capacity to supply prostheses for their own patients. And this is one of the amputees, left arm, and you can note in the right leg that she has a prosthesis, coming from this local peripheral hospital. Tremendous work by the locals to support the local infrastructure. This young kid, you can't see it, but his pants cover his prosthesis on his right lower extremity, but has done phenomenal work with support from physiotherapy in order to now be able to play soccer. Again, one of the things that this shows is that we need a multidisciplinary approach in order to tackle some of the challenges. Just like we do here, we have physiotherapists, nurses, pharmacy, physicians, logisticians. The same thing is in some of the resource-limited settings. And although the physician and surgeon may have done the initial component of care for him, without the physiotherapy, he would not be there. So we really have to have multidisciplinary approaches in order to augment some of this local capacity. So now let's talk about a bit of the extent of the problem and why do we engage in global health. And I'm going to look at it a bit from a surgical side, and I'm going to talk about injury. When we think of global health, we pretty much think of what? We think of HIV, malaria, TB, diarrheal disease, and we see awful pictures of malnourished kids, all of which deserve significant attention. Excuse me. In fact, in the last 5 to 10 years, with the work of the World Health Organization and the Global Burden of Disease Project, we know that injury represents as many deaths annually as HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. There's 5 million injury-related deaths annually, representing almost 10% of global mortality. One of the ways that we measure the effect of injury or disease or a disease state is the disability of adjusted life years lost. And it's pretty much a measure of the years lost to life as a result of ill health. Again, when we look at it, tuberculosis in thousands, 35,000, HIV, 70,000, injury has a significantly greater effect. One of the reasons for that is when we look at some of the images that we saw previously, if you're an amputee in some of these settings, the reality is even here, you're going to have significant challenges in life. Whereas if you're in some of these, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, in some of the low-income nations, an amputation is pretty much, you have very little opportunity for progress for the rest of your life. If you're in Uganda, you have a 10% lifetime risk of dying from an injury. And in Gambia, by the age of 15, by the age of 15, you have a 50% chance of requiring surgery for an injury by the age of 15. That highlights that we need to have better prevention strategies in some of these regions in order to tackle this challenge. Well, what about the local capacity? And these are some numbers out of the WHO, but I can tell you, and you'll see it soon as well, we work in Rwanda, and at the Montreal General Hospital, we have about 12, 14 general surgeons, and we have multiple other hospitals with equivalent capacity here in Montreal. In Rwanda, at the time, this is the data from about 3 years ago, there were 11 general surgeons for 10 million people. 11 general surgeons for 10 million people. That's astronomical. That means the majority of people with surgical disease will not actually arrive at the opportunity and privilege of care that we would otherwise have here. What is the annual cost of road traffic injuries? In addition to the detriments that it has to the social infrastructure, it also has a financial cost. And that's about $500 billion per year. So why should we contribute from here? Well, we have the social responsibility, and as the WHO defines it, health is a human right. And what is health and human rights? It's the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being. Well, why should we care about something that happens in Africa, something that happens in Bangladesh, or any related region? In the 50s, Marshall McLuhan called this the global village. And what's happening is that as communication, travel is improved, then we are in fact interrelated to regions that are otherwise quite distant from us. Whether it's infectious disease that transcends borders, whether it's environmental catastrophes that transcend borders, or whether it's our presence abroad, whether it's outsourcing and multinational companies, we are much more involved and much more intricately involved in events that occur beyond our borders than one would think. And therefore, the health of our surroundings becomes our responsibility. In addition, there is significant disparity between the opportunities that we have here for health and the opportunities in some of our surrounding nations. So, for example, you are 9 times more likely to be to die in a car crash in Kenya than you are in the United States from a similar accident. We see that in Kenya, there's a significant increase in mortality from traffic collisions, while in North America, this is significantly decreased. And the reason for that is likely that there's significantly more automobiles on the road, which we have as well, but we also have prevention strategies, such as seat belts, such as safer cars, safer roads, road traffic lights, et cetera, et cetera. And here's someone that required an amputation because he was hit by a car crossing the street. There's also a significant disparity in how we approach some of these interventions. Now, this is a study looking at chemotherapy for colorectal cancer, which is at the advanced stage. For one medication, irinotecan, the R&D and
was $666 million per year. I'm not saying this is not important. We need to continue to do our research in order to advance medicine. This is absolutely essential. However, we can't forget that if you implement road traffic, if you implement speed bumps in certain regions, you will reduce the mortality by 50% with a significantly lower cost. So why should we contribute from the university? Well, we have this social responsibility and social accountability. We have the knowledge. While having the knowledge, we also have as much to learn as we have to teach. And that's a very important thing. When I went to live in Kenya, I thought I knew a lot. I thought I had the answers, and I thought I would be doing a lot of teaching. In fact, I probably learned more than I taught, and it's a tremendously humbling experience to be there and see how much you, in fact, can learn from some of the local healthcare professionals. In addition, it's incredible. You go to incredible places. And I think it's very important when you embark on a career, whatever it may be, you have to do it for the right reasons. You have to enjoy the work that you're doing. And whether it's going and traveling and seeing cheetahs chase the more weak wildlife, having incredible adventures, you have to enjoy some of these experiences. If you're not, none of us are going out there and saving the world. This is something that we think, you know, well, no. The reality is that you have to enjoy the experience. And in fact, some of the people that I've come across and have become friends with are absolutely incredible individuals. And I owe my profession to some of the partners that and friends that I have all around the world. And again, it's incredibly gratifying. You know, when you see this young girl's smile on her face, this is a young girl that had an open fracture of her knee as a result of the Haiti earthquake, and you see that, it's absolutely incredibly gratifying. What are some of the challenges? You have to understand the local environment in which you work. And that's why it's important that if you're going to practice in global health, you need to spend the time on the ground. Because again, spending the time on the ground, you'll realize that there's more questions than answers. You have to understand the healthcare system, some of the challenges. You have to understand the hospital system. As I previously discussed, you know, we may not, this is a story from that my father actually told me when he was working in Zambia. He would come in, this is in the 70s, he would come in every day to the clinic, he would make his rounds, and he thought it was absolutely unacceptable that patients were sleeping on the ground. And he would say to the nurses, you would have to come and sleep on the bed. This is not proper. And so the next morning, he came and he saw that everybody was sleeping on the beds, but all the beds were dirty. So he says, well, how is that possible? Why is that? So he came in, he said, sleep on the beds. Everybody said, okay, we will sleep on the beds. But they, in fact, slept all night on the ground. And then, just before he came in, they would go into a bed. So you have to understand some of the local settings that you're working in. You have to understand health statistics, the infrastructure, some of the governance that you're working in, and the culture. some of the challenges, especially from a surgical standpoint. In the last 5 to 10 years, there has been an increasing awareness of surgery, and we've again thought that global health was HIV, malaria, and TB, and in general, there's a fear that surgical interventions and surgical capacity building costs a lot of money. Well, in fact, having the capacity to perform an appendectomy, which here we take for granted, it's not a deadly disease here. You come in, you have some pain in your abdomen, you get your surgery, the next day you're at home. In some of these settings, when you don't have access to a surgeon, appendicitis is a deadly disease. So in fact, the dollar amount for the years of lives saved is often cheaper for surgical diseases than some of the medical diseases. So what are the goals for us in global health? We want to have a significant reduction in incidence, morbidity, and mortality from surgical disease. Improve understanding of the local needs. And that's an extremely important point. We need to know and take the guidance of the local healthcare leadership that will express what their challenges are. We can't tell them what the challenge is. We don't live there. We're not citizens of the country. We're really there as consultants to help them build up their own capacity. And we need to make stronger alliances to local universities, hospital, and governance, and work together with these partners in order to improve the capacity. Traditionally, a lot of surgical work was through what we call mission work. And we've all seen this. It's Operation Smile, a hernia mission, and a lot of these last from several days to a week or two. And we touched upon this before. One of the challenges is that while these services or these missions provide a tremendous service to individual patients, as soon as the mission is over, it did nothing for the local capacity, the local healthcare professionals, in order to enable them to provide this care. You have a surgeon that comes in, does 150 cleft lips in 2 weeks, and then when they're gone, well, what happens then? Well, if you train the surgeons or some of the healthcare professionals there to perform the surgery, they can do it year-round. So how do we do that? So what is capacity building? Capacity building really is the improvement of local infrastructure, and that's both material resources and, more importantly, human resources in order to deal with their own health challenges. You do this through disease and injury prevention, education strategies, and system development. How do you do that? Well, by increasing awareness of the problem, research programs, education programs, and very importantly, you have to evaluate and critically evaluate the work that you're doing. It's always great to go and do something that you think is right and come back home and you think you've done all good, but then it's very interesting when you start critically evaluating it, you see how the impact can be significantly improved by listening to some of the local counterparts and understanding how you can improve some of these partnerships and programs. So currently we have programs in Rwanda, the Ukraine, Tanzania, Haiti, Israel, Palestine, Iraq, and Mexico. And we work with local hospitals, universities, governance, NGOs, and the military. our approach really is a multidisciplinary approach. And I'm glad to see that really there's a wide variety of students that are here. We saw also outside, you know, representation from medicine, from nursing, physiotherapy, communication sciences, pharmacy, physiotherapy, because it really is a multidisciplinary approach that is needed to have higher impact programs. So what are some of the programs that we do? In Rwanda, like I said, there's 11 general surgeons. There were 11 general surgeons for a population of about 10 million. Now there are more. And we formed a partnership with the National University of Rwanda and together implemented a curriculum to improve the training of the general surgery trainees. Excuse me. So previously, their program was mostly service-based, which means you came to work, you saw some patients, and you learned on the job, and you went home. It is extremely important to have academic components to the curriculum as well. You want to have lectures, you want to have interactive sessions, case presentations, etc., etc., so that you can learn also outside of the stressful environment of a patient encounter or potentially stressful environment. So together with the National University of Rwanda, we implemented lectures, journal clubs, case presentations, mortality and morbidity rounds, teaching, and this, in fact, we were able to publish in some of the journals. And we do this, again, in partnership with the local leadership and some of the local faculty with whom we work. This is an example of about 15 modules, 2 weeks each, that we implemented in the first year and a half of the program, covering the variety of subspecialties in general surgery. At the same time, we also have research programs, because in order to have a prevention strategy or an education program, you have to understand the extent of the problem. And the best example for that is, well, if I'm going to teach how to manage gunshot wounds in an area that never sees gunshot wounds and they see motor vehicle collisions, then that's a wasted effort. It's the research that's going to give us the ability to understand what the problem is so that we can better target some of the interventions. Some of this research has shown us that, in fact, a great majority of cases and patients are emergency cases, and only about 30% are elective cases. The most common injury that we see is fractures, about 80% of them. And then what we do is we map some of the patterns of referrals in the region. And you see here Kigali in the middle. And about 60% of the patients that are there are referred to from the surrounding regions. And that highlights the importance of an organized system in order to manage these patients. In Tanzania, we've implemented a trauma registry, again, to be able to better describe some of these patterns. We looked at about 4,500 patients. Again, most common injury is orthopedics. And in fact, the overall mortality was only about 1.6%. Well, if, sorry, 0.5%. If mortality was only 0.5%, how come did I just say that injury is a leading cause of death globally? Because they never get to the hospital. This is hospital-based data. So the majority of the patients that have injury to the trunk, to the chest, or abdomen, succumb, unfortunately, before they arrive to the hospital to care. And those that survive are those with orthopedic injuries. And that's why hospital-based mortality is much lower. Again, we look at some of the geographic patterns in order to better characterize where should we focus some of these interventions. We have education programs to match some of the data that we're accruing through the research. So looking what is necessary. So we have trauma programs, trauma education, and this is Dr. Simone Bergman showing how to do a chest tube. We have simulation programs, again, in a multidisciplinary approach using team-based learning with physicians, residents, nurses, respiratory therapists, and students. At the same time, we also do disaster preparedness. So this is how many soccer fans do we have here? That's pretty good. This is in the Ukraine in preparation for the Euro 2012, where we were asked to perform risk assessment and disaster preparedness plans, again, along with our Ukrainian partners. So we did a risk assessment in Russian. And we look at what are the potential hazards and what's their impact if they occur. In Russian. Again, the importance of the local partners cannot be underestimated. Without them, we can't do any of this. Some of the local training in the region, this is in the Ukraine, using simulation with multidisciplinary approaches. Absolutely essential. You can be the best surgeon, the best physician out there. You're nothing without a nurse. So thank you. Some of our local partners did similar type work in Palestine. This is with the former Palestinian Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad. And finally, this is the most important to the students. The students today are the global health leaders tomorrow. And we welcome students' involvement in these projects. The students, I have to say, often challenge us to make sure that we're doing good work and we're doing it properly. And on each one of these projects, we have a significant student participation, whether it's in the research, education, evaluation. The students form an essential part of this work. And it's great to see the enthusiasm of students for global health. We involve the students as well in some of the publications. And this is just one of the examples of it, where students looked at the importance of global health conferences to their careers in global health and the opportunities from those. So, in summary, we discussed some of the challenges that we have in global health. The challenges are great, but it really is a privilege to be able to participate in some of these activities. And some of the paradigms. And again, I think that as we progress into the future, we've gone away from just mission work where we provide a clinical service for a week or two and really are starting to emphasize more and more on capacity building, enabling the local infrastructure, again, human and material resources, more importantly, human resources, to provide services to their own local population. And again, the foundation for any capacity building initiative at any location, at any level, is the people, the friendships, and the partnerships involved. And I would therefore like to thank all of our partners in Rwanda, Tanzania, Ukraine, Haiti, Palestine. I'm just trying to think. Rwanda, and everywhere else around the world. And also thank some of our local leadership here at the hospital and the university for enabling us and giving us the privilege to participate in this work. So I'd like to thank you again for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dan. I think you have question cards that were handed out to you, so if you could, I think some of you will collect them.
What's going on with my voice today?
Need a good laryngologist.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll take the question.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll start the questions, Dan. Here's a good. Let's try to give a little bit of attention to Dr. Deckelbaum. Wow. Okay, we'll try to answer most of these questions. Okay, the first question. As a CGEP student, without having the studies to help as professionals, what can I do to help abroad? It's a good question.
That's an excellent question. And you're already doing it. I think by being involved and by being present here and gaining some of the awareness of the global health challenges, that's a perfect start for getting involved. And as you continue in your careers, it doesn't matter what you're in, whether you're in law all the way to medicine, start identifying mentors and people that you see are doing good work, and speak to them and see what are some of the opportunities. Because like I say, identify the people that you could see as mentors, and hopefully they will engage you in some of their activities in global health. And it doesn't take much, quite honestly. It's, you know, in the beginning, it could be assisting with research. It could be doing lit reviews, and slowly, slowly, as you gain more knowledge, your level of participation in a lot of these activities will increase. But it's making good contacts with leaders in global health.
Good. Here's one. What's the most abnormal surgery you've had to perform? I don't know if it's abnormal or the most difficult, I suppose, or unusual.
That's a good question, and I have to think about that quite hard. I'll tell you about the most humbling experience that I've had. One of those days that you wish you never showed up for work. And it was in Kenya, probably. And it's a good example of the local capacity and how much we need to work together and how much we can learn from some of the local healthcare capacity. I had to go in and perform a biopsy on a young woman. She was 32 years old with a huge mass in her leg. And here in North America, we don't see such advanced disease. It often is years before they get to care in some of these regions. And I thought I was going in and just performing a biopsy and outpatient. And this young woman walked into the operating room. Hello, how are you? Had no problem. And she walked on, jumped onto the operating room bed, and I started performing surgery and did the biopsy. The next thing you know, I got into pretty significant bleeding and started sweating a little bit. And I prided myself on being a trauma surgeon, and I know how to deal with bleeding. So I made the incision a little bigger. Continues to bleed even more. And these tumors, that when they're so advanced, they bleed a lot. A lot. And next thing you know, she's about to die on the operating room table because she's exsanguinated. And here I am. She walked into the operating room, and now she's dying. So I called in one of the other surgeons, a Kenyan, Dr. Dan Raburu, who's about four times my size. And even though my voice is a little bad today, but he has a much deeper voice than I am and much stronger presence. And with one scoop, he pretty much took out the tumor, found the feeding vessels, we ligated them, and this lady went home 3 days later. And again, his expertise in dealing with such advanced pathology that's not something that we got exposed to here in North America. We see things much earlier, much easier to manage. And here I was really learning from some of the local Kenyan surgeons how to deal with some of these problems. Very, very humbling day for me.
Well, it appears from the majority of the questions that the majority of many of you are interested in global health, perhaps as a career. Did you think about this before the lecture, or was this the lecture that turned you on? It's interesting. How many thought about it before that you might want to do something like that in the health sciences? It's interesting. So quite a few of you. Well, it's certainly interesting. There's a question here. It says, before focusing on a global level, shouldn't we prioritize surgical health for Canadians first?
Thank you so much for this, because that's something that I didn't mention during the lecture, but our priority is here. There's no question about it. We have about five trauma surgeons at the Montreal General Hospital, and under no circumstance is care compromised by doing some of this work. So our priority is here. The majority of time spent is here. And this is really extra work that we've been able to engage in, making sure that we continue the injury prevention strategies here. We continue to serve the community. We continue to advance care here in the community. And again, the priority is locally.
Do we have any questions online? I guess when I was listening to your lecture, Dan, it was just overwhelming to hear the statistic. The first statistic you mentioned was one surgeon for one in 500,000 population. So, and you mentioned, I think, just to reemphasize, I'm a surgeon. And I look after about, I would say, less than 5,000 patients. So you can see the difference, what that person has to overcome in some of these developing countries. You also mentioned enjoyment in your career. I think all of you, whether you choose medicine, nursing, or one of the other careers in health sciences, I think you really have to ask yourself that question. What are you going to enjoy for the rest of your working life in one of those fields? I think that's very important. You mentioned the high death rate. I'm just looking at those slides with those people lined up in the operating room. I don't know how you ever got through those lists. Obviously, you mentioned that there's a high death rate. There's a question here. How do you overcome this difficulty as a surgeon dealing with that high death rate?
I think you need to understand like I said, can't save the world. You have to understand what is feasible, what are feasible interventions. And you're going to come across things that are heartbreaking. But on the other hand, you're going to do things that are extremely gratifying, as I showed before. So I think that balance in the end pays off. And you, again, you work with fantastic people. Everybody's striving towards a common goal, which is improving health and decreasing health inequalities. And that's extremely gratifying work. And I think if you keep thinking on the positive side and having goals that are attainable and feasible, then it makes this work, in fact, quite enjoyable.
Does global health care include wartime health care? In other words, removing shrapnel, injuries, that type of thing? Or is it another type of medicine?
No, I think definitely there's different situations, whether it's engaging in baseline functioning of different nations or in response to disasters, whether they are environmental catastrophes or conflicts related. Global health really encompasses all of these areas.
One of the countries you mentioned was Israel. And there's a question here, why do they need help from global surgery? Are they not sufficiently developed in their own country?
I think if you look around pretty much the majority of countries have populations that are less privileged and have less access to care. So in Israel, this population is the Bedouin population, which is a migrant population, and don't have the same opportunities at health as some of the surrounding nations. In addition, it's always good to engage not only with the resource limited, but also the some of the other universities and some of the other health schools of health in order to increase the awareness of some of these challenges and work with them in partnership to tackle some of the challenges in more resource-limited settings.
As far as your own career, how did you get involved in offering your services for global health? Another question related to that is global health a profession or something you do in your extra time?
That's excellent. Actually, I just gave a talk on the professionalization of global health. And that's something that's very important to consider. We often, 20, 30 years ago, you wanted to engage in global health, you pretty much had to, and you went to a resource-limited setting, and you suddenly were a leader in global health. Now we realize that there is a professionalization that is required to global health. Just like you get your degrees in medicine, in law, in management, whatnot, hopefully we are working towards that in global health. And the best reasoning that I can give you for this is some of the things that we saw in Haiti after the earthquake. So clearly, there was an incredible surge of injured patients. There was, however, we also saw a lot of work being performed that we would never do here. There were field amputations being done without anesthesia, without pain medication, and just because we're in a resource-limited setting doesn't mean that we shouldn't have to think of some of the ethical considerations, the medical considerations, in order to provide proper care and appropriate care for some of the injured. So when we talk about the professionalization of global health, we want to make sure that those engaged in global health meet not only professional competencies within their own specialties, but also ethical competencies to engage in some of these activities. I had a significant interest in global health during my medical school training and residency, and I found different leaders, such as Dr. Tarek Razik at the Montreal General Hospital, who engaged in global health, and I pretty much worked with him, and he gave me the initial introduction to work in Tanzania at the time. And since then, slowly, slowly, this has grown.
So there must be other there's a great need for global health, obviously, with populations that you're dealing with. There must be other cities, other institutions that are doing similar things that you're doing. Is that true?
Yes. So I would say most major universities now in North America, in Europe, are engaging in global health activities.
So I guess going back to one of the first questions was how the students here in the audience, how do students get involved in global health if they have an interest? What's the next step? They want to sign up today.
Yeah. Depending what your field, whether you're in nursing, I know, for example, the nursing school here has a very active program in global health. So if you want to engage in nursing, some of the faculty are engaged in programs in Haiti, in South America, in medicine. There's faculty that's involved, the McGill University. We have the global health programs, and there are opportunities. So, for example, tomorrow evening is the Global Health Night for the university at 6 o'clock at the faculty club. And students are going to be presenting some of the work that they've done in resource-limited settings. So, again, even speaking with the students, speaking with some of the leadership in global health, speaking to me, and we can slowly get you engaged in some of these projects.
I just want to announce also that Dr. Deckelbaum is on call tonight at the Hospital for Trauma,
yep.
Correct? We'll have to minimize the number of people that come down if you have questions outside of the questions on the cards. So I'd like to end this evening's session. Unless there's a pressing question from the audience, we'll take one or two. Are there any questions that weren't answered on the cards? Let's take a couple. Yes.
So, pretty much, we don't do neurosurgery. We take care of neurosurgical patients, so traumatic brain injuries. This is our bread and butter, traumatic brain injuries. Anybody that has been a victim of a car crash, violence, et cetera, et cetera. But I do not personally operate on the brain. I usually do not operate on bones, but we manage these patients. Anything to the trunk, cardiac, thoracic, intra-abdominal, vascular, we pretty much do any of that.
I think there was one other hand. Yes.
Given the time constraints that you have, is it better to help as many as you can while you can, or use that time to help others to help themselves? Because you mentioned
I think that's an excellent question. I think the goal is always to improve local capacity. And if you can improve the ability of the local nurses, surgeons, the number of the healthcare professionals in a society, that's the optimal goal. At the same time, in the setting of a disaster, you may not be able to do that. You know, when you have patients like we saw that are lined up that need surgical interventions, you're not going to necessarily go and spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours a day in a lecture. But you can work together at the same time with some of the local healthcare leaderships. And again, everybody's learning during this experience. So a lot of it depends on the scenario that you're working in.
Okay, one more.
It depends. So we do this. I don't get paid to do this. When I take time away, it's time away, and I don't get paid, but I get, depending on the support for the projects, we'll often get reimbursed for flight or whatnot. But at this point, this is not, if you're out there to, it's not paid.
Well, it's a fascinating subject, and thank you very much for contributing tonight to McGill Health Sciences program.
Excellent. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.